Welcome to the January podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Charles. The January issue is on the topic of spinal vascular malformations. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Edward Oldfield, Professor of Neurosurgery and Internal Medicine at the University of Virginia, and Dr. David Peepgrass, Chair of Neurologic Surgery at the Mayo Clinic, discuss diagnosis and treatment of these lesions. Dr. Peepgrass's article, Spinal Extradural Arteriovenous Malformations with Parenchymal Drainage, Venous Drainage Variability and Implications in Clinical Manifestations, appears in this month's issue of Neurosurgical Focus.
David, I wonder if you could begin by summarizing what you think the major findings are in this study.
The paper that Michelle Clark nicely pulled together describes spinal extradural arteriovenous malformations with parenchymal drainage. I would, in my mind, these are fistulae. But what's important is that the fistula is in the epidural space, and rather than the venous drainage staying in the epidural space where it would be completely benign, it finds its way with a retrograde vein venous drainage up a nerve root and then in a retrograde fashion onto the cord, just like the dural fistulae do. But the fistula is in the epidural space, and I think that that's just the expansion of the concept of an extradural or fistula, or the fistula not being on the cord, like a perimedullary fistula or an arteriovenous malformation, but the fistula being somewhere else, and then the retrograde venous drainage making its way onto the cord. And we've all seen cases where the fistula is down in the pelvis and then ascends up the conus, or up the phylum terminale to the conus, and then they get periparesis, and that's certainly been well documented. And I know you have seen as well cases in the head. You treated one of my patients
where the fistula was in the head
and disconnected the venous drainage, and what a revelation that was to me, that all you had to do was disconnect the venous drainage. And so the fistula can be anywhere, but as long as it gets onto the cord, it can cause venous hypertension. And I think we recognize pretty well over the past 20 years or so that the fistula can be in the dura, and now it's pretty clear that it can also be just in the focal epidural space. And what's characteristic of these angiographically is you see this kind of dilated vein or this puddling in the epidural space. On three of the cases, it was very clear that there was a dilated vein. And then from that, in a circuitous fashion, that dilated vein was in the, or that kind of varix was in the epidural space. And then eventually, the vein from that epidural space made its way onto a nerve root and then through the dura and up onto the cord. And interestingly, several of these were in the kind of mid-lumbar area, L3, but one was lumbosacral and so forth.
And when you recognize these, was it only by the preoperative arteriography, or from looking at the individual patient descriptions in the paper, it seems as though some of these, you actually reach the conclusion, at least partially, if not mainly, by your observations at surgery of a very arterialized epidural venous system. Is that true?
That's true. But the neuroradiologist, I think we had seen this pattern of the dilated vein. You know, what we initially thought, oh, they must have a dural AV fistula. And I think what's also important about these is they can present with a clinical picture exactly like a dural AV fistula, whether it be a rather subacute or chronic course to progressive periparesis, but several of them have been very rapid, as sometimes dural fistulae can be too. So the clinical picture was recognized by somebody with a progressive periparesis than an MR scan showing dilated venous channels on the dorsum of the cord or the front and back of the cord, just like a dural fistula was. And then actually now that we've refined MR angiography to the point that MR angiography allows you to see in a subtle way this venous puddling or this dilated varix in the epidural space.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was the suspicion on the part of the neuroradiologist, hey, maybe this might be one of those in the epidural space. And then when the angiogram was done confirming that, yes, the fistula looks like several of others that we've seen, and then at operation, when you reflect the dura, you can see the arterialized veins. Instead of the epidural veins being blue, as they typically are, they're red, and they're pulsatile.
Mm-hmm.
And you put a cut in it, and it spurts arterial blood.
Wondering.
And yet, what's the important part of the treatment? Just disconnect it. And I think if you go intradurally and disconnect it, you'll treat the venous hypertension to the cord. I think the worry is, though, that with this epidural fistula, how do we know it's not going to find another vein in the, you know, from a nerve root somewhere else that it then might shunt onto? So we've advised that you should probably do both, obliterate, try to coagulate and pack the fistula, that dilated vein at least in the epidural space, then open the dura and disconnect the radicular vein as probably the best treatment. I took it one step further with one patient where we recognized this and said, well, the fistula is in the epidural space. And rather than open the dura and disconnect it, I'm going to treat the fistula in the epidural space and see if we can't cure it that way. So we did that, and the patient's early angiogram looked good, but when she came back for her follow-up, she was clinically improved. This was 3 to 4 months after, and she'd had a very rapid development of periparesis. And we did an MR scan, which again showed dilated and pretty prominent veins and I think some residual T2 signal in the cord. So we did another angiogram, and indeed it was filling again. I hadn't gotten it all in the epidural space. So then I went back and just disconnected it intradurally, and then she was cured.
When you had interrupted the extradural and the intradural venous drainage, it obliterated whatever fistula.
Yeah, I think it's probably important to do both, at least recognize both. I don't think we know, it's very likely, I suspect, that if you just disconnected the intradural venous drainage, the patient's neurologic picture would improve and resolve, and there still would be the epidural fistula, and probably of no consequence. And there's people undoubtedly walking around with epidural fistulas that don't drain in a retrograde fashion with a medullary vein onto the cord. And, you know, we see those even with metameric kind of AVMs, you know, these kids with diffuse vascular malformations in the muscle and in the vertebral body and in the segmental fashion, but they don't have myelopathy because they don't drain onto the cord. So
yes, that is quite an interesting mystery about those patients that have those sorts of epidural, extradural AV fistulas.
Uh-huh.
Have a lot of pressure in the epidural venous system.
Yes.
But they don't seem to find a route of entry into the intradural venous system.
No.
So,
and of course, there's an occasional case, and actually that's part of why this got a little muddled, is when we first presented this for publication, we included one that was an epidural arteriovenous fistula or arteriovenous malformation in the neck, and was causing progressive myelopathy, and we embolized that and finally recognized, rather than being a metameric type thing, it was really confined to the epidural space, and we were able to embolize it and then directly attack it, and the myelopathy has been completely resolved. But she had really venous compression of her cervical cord as opposed to venous hypertension related to shunting onto the cord. So I think that's pretty well known. If you have an AV fistula, vertebral artery to venous fistula, say, that those sometimes can cause enough compression that they can affect a cervical cord or nerve root. That's different than venous hypertension. I think these patients get in trouble with venous hypertension just like dural AV fistulae do.
Yes, yes. In fact, you refer to both types
right.
in the paper, but the set of patients that you present all presented with.
Yeah, venous hypertension, and their fistula was in the epidural space. And I think that's the important thing. And we've got enough cases now that we can say, here's a clinical profile. And the clinical profile very much is like dural AV fistula. It's just that the fistula is not in the dura. It's in the epidural space. And it gets onto the cord with the retrograde venous drainage from the epidural space it through the nerve root. And we've tried very hard, while we can demonstrate that connection pretty well angiographically, demonstrating it at operation has been difficult. And that's why I told the artist we need to get some pictures that at least conceptualize it, even though we couldn't see it so clearly at operation. And I strived in two of my cases to say, I got to find that connection in the epidural space. Where is it getting through the dura and the nerve root? And it's hard. I can't say that I could see that.
There seems to be a lot of territory involved in making it much more difficult to precisely define the fistula. What about the venous lakes that you've seen with these patients? Are they always in the extradural veins, or sometimes in the
Those are in the extradural veins. Those are in the epidural veins. That's just a varix of those are probably normal epidural veins in the anterior epidural space. And those are the kind of veins that we coagulate all the time when we do lumbar disc operations. But when they get fistulized, then they get dilated and turn into kind of a arterialized varix. And our angiograms demonstrate that in some of the cases. That's what I think is important to recognize, too.
A few moments ago, you were discussing the fact that you or I may have one of these, and we probably wouldn't even know about it unless it was draining into the intrathecal medullary venous system of the
right.
cord. You all do a lot of arteriograms there at the Mayo Clinic, and I was wondering whether you know whether any of these AV fistulas involving just the extradural system have ever been discovered just incidentally that weren't producing symptoms.
We have seen that, but we haven't, and we don't have anything. We don't have a prospective log to go back and say we know what happened to those patients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like the dural AV fistulae in the head. If you have a prospective log, and you know, if they just drain into the sinus, and then the important question was, do they ever go from just a type 1 fistula to those having leptomeningeal venous drainage? And I guess in very rare circumstances that may happen. You see them early and they look benign, and then very rarely do they ever convert to something of a more aggressive nature. I suppose, you know, these fistulae may exist, and very rarely they may eventually recruit some retrograde radicular venous drainage onto the cord. But I don't know that. That would just be something to be demonstrated in the future.
I see. Dave, do you have any sort of take-home messages that you think would be most important for most neurosurgeons to know about from your experience with these lesions?
I think the take-home message is when you see the patient with progressive periparesis and your neuroradiologist recognizes abnormal venous drainage and T2 signal in the spinal cord, number one, be first suspicious of a dural AV fistula because it's treatable, and if diagnosed early, the the entity can be treated, whether endovascularly or operatively, and the patient restored to normal function. So often, though, I think it still happens that even though this picture is identified, these patients go along and diagnosis is delayed and neurologic deficits progress and become irreversible. And so patients that have this picture need to get to a place where they have good spinal angiography and the entity can be recognized and treated expeditiously. Beyond that, there's a very small subset of patients, very small, I suspect, where the fistula is not in the dura, but in the epidural space. If you can recognize that, as has not been done in the past, and probably there's more than we think, but if you recognize that, maybe it's important to treat the fistula both in the epidural space as well as disconnecting it. But at least from the practical matter, if you went intradurally and disconnected it, you've probably definitively treated the patient's neurologic deficit, although follow-up needs to be, you know, if the fistula is still in the epidural space and it's unrecognized, then continued follow-up, and if the patient didn't get better, further angiography would be important.
Good, good. David, I think this is quite an important contribution. I sure appreciate you putting it together. I'm sure our readers of Neurosurgery Focus and throughout neurosurgery will read it with interest and be thankful
good
that you put it together.
Well, I'll give credit to Michelle Clark, who did the legwork and pulling the cases together and hearing each of us and seeing that the artist drawings were done, and also to Danielle Rufinack, who in 1991 told me, pay attention to where this fistula is because it's not a dural fistula. And Danielle was very sage, and he was exactly right.
Very good. Well, thanks
okay
so much.
You bet.
Goodbye now.
This concludes our podcast for the January issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the February issue when the topic will be peripheral nerve surgery. For more information on how to submit your research to Neurosurgical Focus or to see a list of upcoming topics, please visit therjns.org and click on Neurosurgical Focus. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@therjns.org.